Not that such distinctions matter to me. The easier the better, so far as I'm concerned. I am more interested in the pikas squealing under the rocks, in the subalpine buttercups on the grassy patches, in the furtive elusive gray spiders that dance over the slabs before me, than in engineering exercises with nylon rope, carabiners, brake bars, pitons, slings, crampons, star drills, and expansion bolts. For the present, anyway. I can hear the pikas all around me signaling each other with their whistles, but never catch a glimpse of one. They stay in their tunnels and lairs under the rock, listening to the strange two-legged monster stumbling over their homes. Pika, a hare-like mammal, a lagomorph, having two pairs of upper incisors, one set behind the other. Why? The better to gnaw the tough roots of the scrubby tundra plants. When I reach one of the island-like areas of solid rock in the midst of the scree, I lie down for a while to catch my breath and examine at close range, 6 inches, the buttercups. The sticky polemonium, the moss campion, lovely name, and the miniature alpine violets with their flowers no bigger than the head of a thumbtack. I also hope to find the flower called Rocky Mountain Pussytoes, a favorite of mine for no better reason than the name. Here are the buttercups, alpine or subalpine, with their hairy sepals, divided leaves, shiny yellow petals. Hold one close to your nose, the old wives say, and if your nose reflects the yellow, you are a butter lover. I have no mirror with me except a knife blade and do not perform the experiment. In any case, the game was not meant for the solitary, but for two alone, lad and lass, man and maid. Sticky polemonium has an engaging sound. It is a tiny tubular purplish flower with orange antlers, clusters of them on fuzzy stalks about 10 inches high. Polemonium viscosum, alias sky pilot, for it often lives at 13,000 feet or more. As for the moss campion, I am lying on it. It makes a pleasant cushioning on the rock, and the small pink flowers will not be damaged by my temporary sojourn here. It won't do to pause for long on a mountain climb. The longer you rest, the harder it is to get up and go on. The steady ox-like plod is best. I rise from the flower bed and continue, moving up from rock to shaky rock, sliding, slipping, sometimes losing ground, but gaining in the long run. The long field of snow looks good, and I make straight for it, hoping the snow will be firm enough to climb, soft enough to kick toeholds in. I am also eager for a drink of water. The keen chill air of the upper world whets my thirst, and I'm carrying no water in my pack. I am already close enough to the snowfield to hear the muted roar, as of an underground waterfall, of the melted snow rushing downward through the piled slabs over which I struggle. Coming near the edge of the snowfield, I find running water close to the surface, visible among the rocks. I stop to drink. The water is bitterly, brilliantly cold, with particles of glacial grit. Utterly delicious. A few more steps and I reach the snowfield, which extends for 1,000 feet, bell-curved, up through the couloir toward the summit. It looks like it might go. I advance upon it slowly and carefully, kicking out footholds as I climb. The snow is firm, solid, as expected, and at first it seems easier to go this way. But the kicking of niches becomes tiring. An ice axe would be handy now. Also, one false step, one slip, and I'll be back down at my starting point in seconds. Somewhat regretfully, I decide to leave the snow and traverse over to the rocks, continuing the climb up those unstable fragments. It seems odd that the mountainside should be covered with this loose debris, but so it is with Tukanikovats. Nearly symmetrical, like a volcano, it is weathered evenly on all sides, unlike its neighbor Mount Peel, for instance, which can be reached over spurs and ridges of solid base rock, which is also, for that matter, a little bit higher, according to the surveyors. Then why climb Tukanikovats? Because I prefer to. Because no one else will if I don't, and somebody has to do it. Because it is the most dramatic in form of the LaSalles, the most conspicuous and beautiful as seen from my terrace in the arches. Because, finally, I like the name. Tuckanickavots, in the language of the Utes, where the sun lingers. The mountain resists me. Slowly, laboriously, I struggle upward, clambering over the tricky slabs. Halfway up, the mountain hits me with a sudden storm. First the wind, and a sinister clot of gray scud crawling over the peak. Then a rain of sleet, followed by hailstones that bombard me like a cascade of marbles. I have put on my jacket, pulled my hat tight on my skull. I keep on climbing. What else can I do? There's no shelter, and little comfort in simply standing still and suffering. In a few minutes the storm melts away, the clouds break, the sun comes out to warm my body and melt the hailstones that are piled like mothballs in every cranny among the rocks. As the weather improves, so does the terrain. The scree gives way to outcroppings of solid country rock which I climb to reach the firm grass-covered dome of the peak. A cairn of stones over the brass-headed benchmark of the geodetic survey marks the highest point, and there I sit to eat my lunch, shielded from the wind by the cairn, and drenched in warmth from a sun that has never seemed so close, so dazzling, in such a dark and violet sky. The sun, in fact, has changed color. Seen from the desert, it is a golden glare, and sometimes, on the horizon or during a sandstorm, red as blood. But from here, at 13,000 feet above sea level, the sun is a white star, a white fire, fierce as radium, burning in a sky of deeper, darker blue. Peeling an orange, I survey the larger globe below. All around the peaks of the Sierra LaSalle lies the desert, a sea of burnt rock, arid tablelands, barren and desolate canyons. The canyon country is revealed from this magnificent height, as on a map, and I can imagine, if not read, the names on the land. The folk poetry of the pioneers. Desolation Canyon, Labyrinth Canyon, Stillwater Canyon, Dark Canyon, Happy Canyon, Cohabitation Canyon, Nigger Bill Canyon, Recapture Canyon, Molly's Nipple, The Bishop's Prick, Queen Anne's Bottom, Dirty Devil River, Onion Creek, Last Chance Creek, Salvation Creek, Moonlight Wash, Grand Gulch, Cigarette Spring, Stinking Spring, Hog Spring, Squaw Spring, Frenchman's Spring, Matrimony Spring, Arsenic Spring, Wooden Shoe Butte, Window Blind Peak, Looking Glass Rock, Lizard Rock, Elephant Hill, Turk's Head, Candlestick Spire, Cleopatra's Chair, Jacob's Ladder, Copper Globe, Black Box, Water Pocket Fold, Sinbad Valley, Beef Basin, Fable Valley, Ruin Park, Devil's Pocket, Robber's Roost, Goblin Valley, Soda Springs Basin, Potato Bottom Basin, Cyclone Lane, Buckhorn Flat, Surprise Valley, The Big Draw, Professor Valley, Kodachrome Flats, Calamity Mesa, Upheaval Dome, Poison Strip, Yellow Cat, Hidden Splendor, Happy Jack, Rattlesnake, Mi Vida, all uranium mines, Ernie's Country, Pete's Mesa, Zeke's Hole, Pappy's Pasture, Wolf Hole and Poverty Knoll, Pucker Pass, where the canyon puckers up, and Hooray Pass, Hooray We Made It, Tavaputs, Kaiparowitz, Toro Weep, Owachamo, Hoven Weep, Dinahutso, Huskanini, Dotklish, Betatakan, Keetseal, Tesnos Pass, Kayenta, Agathla, Tuckanickavots, Grand Mesa, Thunder Mesa, Wild Horse Mesa, Horse Thief Point, Dead Horse Point, Grand View Point, Land's End, Capitol Reef, San Rafael Swell, Dandy Crossing, a dandy place to cross the river, Hell's Backbone, Big Rock Candy Mountain, Book Cliffs, Hondu Arch, Angel Arch, Druid Arch, delicate arch, the needles, the standing rocks, the maze, Dugout Ranch, Lonesome Beaver Camp, Berea, Bundyville, Hanksville, Bluff, Mexican Hat, Mexican Water, Bitter Springs, Kanab, Bedrock and Paradox, Moab. Compare 2 Kings chapter 3, the Holy Bible. The wind stops completely as I finish my lunch. I strip and lie back in the sun, high on Takanikavats, with nothing between me and the universe but my thoughts. Deliberately I compose my mind, quieting the febrile buzzing of the cells and circuits, and strive to open my consciousness directly, nakedly, to the cosmos. Under the influence of cosmic rays I try for cosmic intuitions, and end up earthbound, as always, with a vision not of the universal, but of a small and mortal particular, unique and disparate. Her smile, her eyes in firelight, her touch. Well, let it be. You'll find no deep thinkers at 13,000 feet anyway. The wind comes up again. I get to my feet and dance along the cornice of a snowbank that hangs above the void. Down there in the forest somewhere is my camp, my old truck, my fireplace, home. I look for a quick and easy way to return. The climb up from Timberline had taken about 2 hours. Looking down at the graceful curve of the 1,000-foot snowfield, it seems to me that the descent should not require more than 5 minutes. I put on my clothes, shoulder the rucksack, and work down over the rock to the couloir and the upper end of the slide. It looks too steep. Experimentally, I push a slab onto the snow and let it go. It drops away rapidly, picking up speed and throwing a spray of snow into the air, turns on edge and rolls and bounds like a clumsy wheel all the way to the bottom, shattering on the rocks below. A certain length of time passes before I hear the sound of the explosion. What I need is a braking device. An ice axe now would be the thing. I could squat on my heels and glissade down the snowfield in good form, controlling direction and velocity by dragging the blade in the snow. I launch a second big stone and watch it go down, sliding, then skimming over the hard snow, faster and faster until, like the first, it catches on something, turns on its edge, and bounces like a wheel the rest of the way down. I see it now. The point is to stay flat. The pitch of the snowfield is less steep toward the bottom. It should be possible to slow down or stop before smashing into the rocks at the lower edge. I choose a third flat rock and drag it to the margin of the snowfield. Facing downhill with my heels braced in the snow, I straddle the rock, grasp and elevate its forward edge with both hands, my stick tucked under my arm, and sit down firmly, taking a deep breath. Nothing happens. My feet are still dug in and seem unwilling to obey my command to rise. Instinct more powerful than reason. I urge them again. Grudgingly, they come up. Look at it this way, fellows. Nobody lives forever. The descent begins. Too late for arguments now, and as usual, not enough time for panic. We are sledding down the mountain at a sensational clip, accelerating according to formula. I break my speed with my boot heels as best I can, but can't see a thing because of the gush of snow flying in my face. Halfway down, I lose the slab I'm riding and go on for a piece without it. The rock follows hard upon me, almost at my neck. I manage to recapture it and climb partway back on, but before I can get comfortable again, I see an outcrop of immovable granite, which I hadn't noticed before, rising in our path. I abandon the slab, roll to the side, and go skidding past the obstacle by an adequate margin. Things are out of control at this point, but fortunately the snowfield begins to level off. I get my boots in front of my body, dig in, and coast to a stop a few feet short of the broken rocks at the bottom of the couloir. As I sit there resting, another loose object thunders by on my left, perhaps the same rock or part of it that I had started down with. A moment later, comes my walking stick. Everything seems to be in good shape, except my hands, which are bruised and numb, and the heels and soles of my boots, which are hanging to the uppers by a few threads and a couple of bent nails. I hammer them back together with a stone and continue my descent the hard way, crawling over the rubble until I reach the scrub spruce and the fringe of the forest. The ascent of Tukanikovats has taken me half the day. The descent from summit to timberline less than half an hour. I have plenty of time before sundown for another hike. But the boots are in a bad way, soles flapping like loose tongues at every step, my frozen toes sticking out, the heels twisted out of line. I limp back to camp to exchange them for something else. On the way, in an area where spruce and fir mingle with quaking aspen, in a cool, shady, well-watered place, I discover a blue columbine, rarest and loveliest of mountain flowers. This one is growing alone. Perhaps the deer have eaten the others. There must have been others. And where's therefore the special beauty of all wild and lonely things? Silently I dedicate the flower to a girl I know, and in honor both of her and the columbine, open my knife and carve something appropriate in the soft white bark of the nearest aspen. 50 years from now, my inscription will still be there, enlarged to twice its present size by the growth of the tree. May the love I feel at this moment for columbine, girl, tree, symbol, grass, mountain, sky, and sun also stay, also grow, never die. Back to camp. My feet are wet and cold. I build a fire and toast my bare feet lightly in the flames until sensation is restored. The glade is quiet except for the whisper of aspen leaves and running water, the air warm in the late afternoon sunlight. There is no wind here, though I can see by the streamers of cloud off the peaks that it is still blowing up above. I put on dry socks and moccasins and cook my supper, refried pinto beans with chili, and a number of eggs, a potato baked in tinfoil. I am very hungry. Tea and cigar for the final course. The quiet forest. There are few birds in the high woods, less wildlife it seems than down below in the sun-baked desert. Probably because at this altitude the summer is so brief, much too beautiful to last, and the winter long. One bird, however, is singing, if you could call it singing. The song is so laconic and melancholic that it very nearly takes all the joy out of my smoke. I don't know what kind of bird it is, if it is a bird, but the song goes like this, repeated over and over, lentissimo. Treble clef in 4/4 time, 16th note C, quarter note E, quarter note C, half rest, quarter note B, quarter note A, half rest, whole rest, repeat, 16th note C, quarter note E, quarter note C, half rest, quarter note B, quarter note A, half rest. When I've had enough of this sentiment, there is a bird called the Townsend solitaire, I get up and walk away, out to the dirt road beyond the old rail fence and up the road to a wide meadow from which I can watch the sun go down over the western world. Mesa, canyon, and plateau, the Pacific desert lies in whiskey-colored light and lilac dusk, a sea of silence. Clouds edged with fire sail on the clear horizon. Somebody's goddamned cows, Scobies perhaps, or McKees, I can't see the brand, gape at me from the lower side of the meadow. I wave my arm and stick at them, and they bolt suddenly for the trees like deer. I walk among thistles and coarse dying goldenrod, signs of overgrazing, and a kind of sunflower called five-nerve helianthella, knock a few heads off, helping to spread the seed, and ponder the meaning of my solitude, reaching no conclusions. Tomorrow, Deo Valente, I plan a walk to the summit of the pass between Tukanikovats and Mount Temaski. There is a little lake not far over the saddle, a tarn, really, a mountain pond bordered in marsh marigold and yarrow, with water black and glassy as obsidian. Bottomless? Certainly. There are some old friends living there whom I haven't seen for a long time. Afterwards, back to Moab, back to the juniper, the red sand, and the fantastic rocks. Into September, the final month. Episodes and Visions.
Ranger, where is Arch's National Monument?
I don't know, mister, but I can tell you where it was. Labor Day. Flux and influx, the final visitation of the season, they come in herds, like buffalo, down from the city. A veil of dust floats above the sneaky, snaky old road from here to the highway, drifting gently downwind to settle upon the blades of the yucca, the mustard-yellow rabbit brush, the petals of the asters and autumn sunflowers, the umbrella-shaped clumps of blooming wild buckwheat. What can I tell them? Sealed in their metallic shells like mollusks on wheels, how can I pry the people free? The auto is tin can, the park ranger is opener. Look here, I want to say. For God's sake, folks, get out of them there machines. Take off those fucking sunglasses and unpeel both eyeballs. Look around. Throw away those goddamned idiotic cameras. For Christ's sake, folks, what is this life if full of care we have no time to stand and stare, huh? Take off your shoes for a while, unzip your fly, piss hardy, dig your toes in the hot sand, feel that raw and rugged earth, split a couple of big toenails, draw blood. Why not? Jesus Christ, lady, roll that window down. You can't see the desert if you can't smell it. Dusty? Of course it's dusty. This is Utah. But it's good dust. Good red Utahn dust. Rich in iron, rich in irony. Turn that motor off. Get out of that piece of iron and stretch your varicose veins. Take off your brassiere and get some hot sun on your old wrinkled dugs. You, sir, squinting at the map with your radiator boiling over and your fuel pump vapor locked, crawl out of that shiny hunk of GM junk and take a walk. Yes, leave the old lady and those squalling brats behind for a while. Turn your back on them and take a long, quiet walk straight into the canyons. Get lost for a while. Come back when you damn well feel like it. It'll do you and her and them a world of good. Give the kids a break, too. Let them out of the car. Let them go scrambling over the rocks hunting for rattlesnakes and scorpions and anthills. Yes, sir, let them out. Turn them loose. How dare you imprison little children in your goddamned upholstered horseless hearse? Yes, sir, yes, madam, I entreat you. Get out of those motorized wheelchairs. Get off your foam rubber backsides. Stand up straight like men, like women, like human beings, and walk, walk, walk upon our sweet and blessed land.
Where's the Coke machine?
Sorry, lady, we have no Coke machine out here. Would you like a drink of water? She's not sure.
Say, Ranger, that's a god-awful road you got in here. When the hell are they going to pave it?
They gather round, listening. The day before I leave. I say it with a smile. They laugh.
Well, how the hell do we get out of here?
You just got here, sir.
I know, but how do we get out?
Same way you came in. It's a dead-end road. So we see the same scenery twice?
It looks better going out. Oh, Ranger, do you live in that little house trailer down there?
Yes, madam, part of the time. Mostly I live out of it.
Are you married?
Not seriously.
You must get awfully lonesome way out here.
No, I have good company.
Your wife?
No, myself. They laugh. They all think I'm kidding.
Well, what do you do for amusement?
Talk with the tourists. General laughter.
Don't you even have a TV?
TV? Listen, lady, if I saw a TV out here, I'd get out my cannon and shoot it like I would a mad dog right in the eye.
Goodness, why do you say that?
What's the principle of the TV, madam?
Goodness, I don't know.
The vacuum tube, madam. And you know what happens if you stick your head in a vacuum tube?
If you stick your head...
I'll tell you. You get your brains sucked out. laughter.
"Hey, old buddy, how far from here to Lubbock?"
"Where's Lubbock, sir?"
"Texas, old buddy. Lubbock, Texas."
"Well, sir, I don't know exactly how far that is, but I'd guess it's not nearly far enough."
"Any dangerous animals out here, Ranger?"
"Just tourists." Laughter. "Tell the truth, they never believe you."
"Where do you keep these here arches, anyway?"
"What arches? All I see around here are fallen arches."
"Does it ever rain in this country, Ranger?"
"I don't know, madam. I've only been here 11 years.
"Well, you said yesterday it wasn't going to rain, and it did rain."
"Did I? Well, that shows you you can't ever trust the weather."
"You work out here all year round?"
"No, sir. Just for the summer."
"What do you do in the winter?"
"I rest."
"How much do you get paid for this kind of work?"
"Too much. But I give part of it back April 15th. And then, after a brief and deadly dull lecture on the geology of the arches, I send them on to the campgrounds and picnic grounds. Be sure to let me know if you get lost." Relieved, happy, and laughing. "It's a great country. You can say whatever you like so long as it is strictly true. Nobody will ever take you seriously." In the evening, about supper time, feeling somewhat guilty and contrite, for they are, most of them, really good people, and not actually as simple-minded as they pretend to encourage me to pretend us all to be, I visit them again around the fires and picnic tables, help them eat their pickles and drink their beer, and make perhaps a trace of contact by revealing that I, too, like most of them, come from that lost village back in the hills, am also exiled, a displaced person, an internal immigrant in this new America of concrete and iron which none of us can quite understand or accept or wholly love. I may also, if I am lucky, find one or two or three with whom I can share a little more. Those rumors from the underground, where whatever hope we still have must be found. Among the visitors on this last big weekend are many Moabites, and other native Utahns, the Mormons, the Latter-day Saints. Some of my liberalized friends regard the LDS with disdain. They see in the church only a bastion of sectarian foolishness and political reaction, and in its adherents a voting bloc of know-nothings, racially prejudiced, religiously bigoted, opposed alike to the graduated income tax, the United Nations, urban renewal, foreign aid, legislative reapportionment, public welfare, Medicare, and even free lunches for school children. Actually or potentially a rabble of John Birchers. "What can you expect," they ask, "of a sect which gave Utah a governor like John Bracken Lee and Eisenhower a secretary of agriculture like Ezra T. Benson? Which denies full church membership to Negroes because they are believed to be the outcast sons of Ham? Whose patron saint was an angel called Moroni? Whose founding father, Joseph Smith, claimed to have carried about under his arms solid gold tablets, which, if they were the size he said they were, no one else ever saw them, would have weighed about half a ton. Gold, a very heavy metal, specific gravity 19.3. Whose official newspaper, the Deseret News, solemnly proclaims on its masthead, 'We believe that the Constitution of the United States was divinely inspired,' but fails to explain why the Almighty changed his mind on the 18th Amendment. One can grant the accuracy of these charges without conceding that the Mormon religion is any more whimsical on points of doctrine than most other sects. The Baptists, for example, with their insistence on total immersion as a prerequisite to the salvation of the soul. All Christians must be totally immersed. In what or for how long not being clearly specified. Or the Jews, with their prepuce-collecting Yahweh, who created light on the first day and several days later, apparently as an afterthought, created the sun. 6 days he labored, on the seventh he was arrested. Or the Roman Catholics with their dogmatic assertion of the physical assumption of the Virgin Mary, launching her on a flat trajectory into outer space like a shot off a shovel, without even a crash helmet or a pressure suit. Or the Hindus with their sanctified ritual for nasal emunction, only one nostril may be discharged at a time, etc. or the small-town atheist, for that matter, with his little blue books and sneering jokes against ancient and venerable institutions. Leaving aside the comical aspects of their creed, one can argue that the Mormons in practice achieved a way of life in which there was much to admire, much worth saving. In addition to their pioneering migrations, full of unusual heroism and examples of fortitude, for example Brigham Young and his 17 wives, the Mormons deserve respect for settling the most rugged, difficult, as well as spectacular terrain in the West. What was unusual, however, was their communitarian approach to the problems of settlement in an inhospitable environment. Their emphasis on mutual aid, cooperation, and sharing was not unknown among other American communities, and indeed such qualities are vital to survival in a frontier situation. But the Mormons went about it in a far more deliberate, conscious manner, with more successful results. For example, in settling a given area, they did not scatter themselves abroad over the landscape in isolated farms and ranches, each man for himself and the devil take the hindmost, but rather built small, rational, beautiful, and durable towns in which all could live together, centered about the church, which served not only as a religious center, but also as a social and political focal point for the community, in this respect harking back to the model of New England. Irrigation systems were then built with the cooperative labor of all, the irrigable land divided fairly among the member families, and the backcountry, canyon and mesa, left open to all who might wish to engage in cattle raising as well as farming. And nearly all did. This formed the open range until the advent of large-scale fencing and the Taylor Grazing Act closed it off to all but an established few. Each community, through the church, also set up what we may call a public welfare service to provide sufficient and generous aid to those brought down by accident, illness, bad luck, or other misfortune. In sum, the Mormons built coherent, self-sustaining communities with a vigorous common life, in which all could participate, free of any great disparities in wealth, small enough to make each member important. There was even room for the dissenter and nonconformist. Every town had a few Jack Mormons, those who smoked tobacco, drank tea or coffee or hard liquor, and perhaps even joined the Democratic Party. Subsequently swamped by the new American mode, by industrialism, commercialism, urbanism, rugged and ragged individualism, the old Mormon communities are now disappearing. But in such small towns as Moab, Kanab, Boulder, and Escalante, we can still see the handsome homes of hand-carved sandstone blocks, the quiet streets lined with irrigation ditches and giant cottonwoods, the gardens and irrigated pastures, the children riding their horses, which remind us on the downhill side of the 20th century of what life must have been like back in the 19th. On its gentle side, that is. As for the people themselves, at least those whom I have come to know in and around Moab, they are generally very conservative in their political opinions, yes, and old-fashioned in their morality. But despite this, or because of it, have the usual virtues of country people, are friendly, hospitable, honest, self-reliant, and self-confident. Not very interesting, perhaps, but good to know, good to have as friends and neighbors. Capable of taking care of themselves and with the means to do it, it is not surprising that they question the justice of being taxed by the federal government in order to help support the teeming proletariat, literally and etymologically the reproducers, of cities which to some of these independent people seem as remote and foreign as Calcutta or Cairo. All of this is now under change, of course, and in the accelerating process of urbanization, the Mormons of Utah are already discovering their interdependence with the rest of the nation and with the world. Certainly in Salt Lake City itself there is no lack of intriguing social problems, air pollution, traffic jams, angry adolescents, babies born from sinlock, and all the rest of it, and very soon the Latter-day Saints will be forced to confront directly the symptoms of discontent and desperation with which most Americans are now familiar. From LDS to LSD, even unto the land of Moab. In the meanwhile, the desert people persist in some of their quaint and antiquated ways. Leslie McKee's wife, a sweet and kindly woman and a pillar of the church, tells me that she has unilaterally bound my soul to hers, in accordance with the teaching of her faith, which has provided this unusual technique for the salvation of souls which otherwise would obviously be lost and shoveled into hell. This binding means, if I understand her rightly, that when she goes to heaven, my soul likewise will be dragged along like the tail of a kite, with or without my consent. And suppose she goes to hell? She assures me that this cannot happen, that she has already been saved and the place reserved for both of us. But I am not entirely set at ease. Something might go wrong. Furthermore, she is a generation older than I. What about the time factor? Is my soul to be prematurely and summarily unhouseled in its prime, if, as seems likely, her demise precedes mine by some 20 or 30 years? On this point she is uncomfortably vague. Perhaps it is all a sinister scheme to rid the world of the pagan Gentile without incurring suspicion. However, it's too late now. Like it or not, I am on my way. We're marching to Zion, to beautiful, beautiful Zion. We're marching upward to Zion, the beautiful city of love. It does not, after all, sound unpromising. God knows I have little to lose. But let's not hurry. What's the rush? Fresh snow on Tukanikovats and the other high peaks. They gleam like alabaster towers under the noon sun and glow at evening in a soft, subtle shade of rosy pink, like mighty cones of strawberry ice cream. Very attractive. I prefer the desert. Why? Because there's something about the desert. Not much of an answer. There are mountain men, there are men of the sea, and there are desert rats. I am a desert rat. But why? And why, in precisely what way, is the desert more alluring, more baffling, more fascinating than either the mountains or the oceans? The majority of the world's great spirits, from Homer to Melville and Conrad, have felt the call of the sea and responded to its power and mystery, its rhythm, antiquity, and apparent changelessness. And the mountains, at least since Rousseau, anticipated by Petrarch, and that great expansion of human consciousness called the Romantic Movement, which opened up for men a whole new world of truth, have been explored and celebrated, strenuously, if not adequately, by swarms of poets, novelists, scientists, and frostbitten, inarticulate, because it's there, mountain climbers. The desert, however, has been relatively neglected. Not entirely, of course. There was T.E. Lawrence, who liked the desert because, as he said, it is clean. And another mad Englishman, C.M. Doughty, travels in Arabia Deserta, who almost never came back. A few Americans have tried to understand the desert, Mary Austin in her book Land of Little Rain, John C. Van Dyke in an unjustly forgotten book The Desert, Joseph Wood Crutch with The Voice of the Desert, the contemporary novelists Paul Bowles and William Eastlake in part of their work, but only in an incidental way, and such obscure figures as the lad Everett Roos, author of On Desert Trails, who disappeared at the age of 26 into the canyon country of southern Utah, never to return. This happened back in the late 30s. His burrows were found, part of his gear, but the young man himself, never. For all we know, he is still down in there somewhere, living on prickly pear and wild onions, communing with the gods of river, canyon, and cliff. Also deserving of mention in this mere preliminary sketch of a desert bibliography are the historical studies by Wallace Stegner, Beyond the 100th Meridian, and Mormon Country, and of course the classic Exploration of the Colorado River and its Canyons by Powell. None of the works I have named attack directly the problem to which I wish to address myself here. What is the peculiar quality or character of the desert that distinguishes it in spiritual appeal from other forms of landscape? In trying to isolate this peculiarity, if it exists at all and is not simply an illusion, We must beware of a danger well known to explorers of both the micro and the macrocosmic, that of confusing the thing observed with the mind of the observer, of constructing not a picture of external reality, but simply a mirror of the thinker. Can this danger be avoided without falling into an opposite but related error, that of separating too deeply the observer and the thing observed, subject and object, and again falsifying our view of the world? There is no way out of these difficulties. You might as well try running Cataract Canyon without hitting a rock. Best to launch forth boldly, with or without life jackets. Keep your matches dry and pray for the best.
The restless sea, the towering mountains, the silent desert. What do they have in common, and what are the essential differences?
Grandeur, color, spaciousness, the power of the ancient and elemental, that which lies beyond the ability of man to wholly grasp or utilize, these qualities all three share. In each there is the sense of something ultimate, with mountains exemplifying the brute force of natural processes, the sea concealing the richness, complexity, and fecundity of life beneath a surface of huge monotony, and the desert? What does the desert say? The desert says nothing. Completely passive, acted upon but never acting, the desert lies there like the bare skeleton of being, spare, sparse, austere, utterly worthless, inviting not love but contemplation. In its simplicity and order it suggests the classical, except that the desert is a realm beyond the human, and in the classicist view only the human is regarded as significant or even recognized as real. Despite its clarity and simplicity, however, the desert wears at the same time, paradoxically, a veil of mystery. Motionless and silent, it evokes in us an elusive hint of something unknown, unknowable, about to be revealed. Since the desert does not act, it seems to be waiting. But waiting for what? In sailing the ocean, we reach the other shore and find, as we should have expected, everything much the same on either side. During the voyage, we see only the unvarying expanse of heaving green or gray, and an empty sky, and not very much of either. The horizon at sea is only 12 miles away. In other words, the journey is the central thing, the expectation of what is to come. The ocean itself is merely a medium of travel. Only a trip by air or space is more abstract, more synthetic, from the passenger's point of view. When and if our astronauts are actually launched off to the moon or Mars through the cold black and white of space, they will, I predict, be expertly drugged beforehand. How else could they endure the coffin-like confinement, the static surroundings of such a venture? The most appealing part of the sea, in fact, is its meeting with the land. It is the seashore which men love, and not the ocean itself. We are not writing here of the seafarer's trade or of the underwater world. In climbing a mountain, if we persevere, we reach the summit. We get, you might say, to the point. Once on the mountain top, there is nothing to do but come down again. The weather up there is usually too hostile for delay. The situation is not suitable for reflection and meditation. Descending the mountain, we enter by degrees into a friendlier, more comfortable, more human environment, forest, rushing streams, sunny meadows, and soon hear the cowbells, see the villages and roads, all that is familiar and reassuring. The desert is different. Not so hostile as the snowy peaks, nor so broad and bland as the ocean's surface, it lies open, given adequate preparation, to leisurely exploration, to extended periods of habitation. Yet it can hardly be called a humane environment. What little human life there is will be clustered about the oases, natural or man-made. The desert waits outside, desolate and still and strange, unfamiliar and often grotesque in its forms and colors, inhabited by rare furtive creatures of incredible hardiness and cunning, sparingly colonized by weird mutants from the plant kingdom, most of them as spiny, thorny, stunted, and twisted as they are tenacious. There is something about the desert that the human sensibility cannot assimilate, or has not so far been able to assimilate. Perhaps that is why it has scarcely been approached in poetry or fiction, music or painting. Every region of the United States except the arid West has produced distinguished artists, or has been represented in works of art which have agreed upon general significance. Only the hacks rush in where genius hesitates to tread, and the baffling reality is lost behind the dust clouds thrown up by the herds of Zane Greys and Max Brands, by the anonymous painters of sugar-sweet landscapes and Roman Indian portraits that clutter up certain galleries, and by those tough old humorous retired cow ladies whose memoirs are so lovingly reprinted by the regional university presses. No life for a lady, no high adobe, no time for tea, no sin in the saddle, etc. Behind the dust, meanwhile, under the vulture-haunted sky, the desert waits. Mesa, butte, canyon, reef, sink, escarpment, pinnacle, maze, dry lake, sand dune, and barren mountain, untouched by the human mind.
Even after years of intimate contact and search, this quality of strangeness in the desert remains undiminished.
Transparent and intangible as sunlight, yet always and everywhere present, it lures a man on, from the red-walled canyons to the smoke-blue ranges beyond, in a futile but fascinating quest for the great, unimaginable treasure which the desert seems to promise. Once caught by this golden lure, you become a prospector for life, condemned, doomed, exalted. One begins to understand why Everett Roos kept going deeper and deeper into the canyon country, until one day he lost the thread of the labyrinth. Why the old-time prospectors, when they did find the common sort of gold, gambled, drank, and hoarded away as quickly as possible and returned to the burnt hills and the search. The search for what? They could not have said. Neither can I. And would have muttered something about silver, gold, copper, anything as a pretext. And how could they hope to find this treasure which has no name and has never been seen? Hard to say. And yet, when they found it, they could not fail to recognize it. Ask Everett Roos. Where is the heart of the desert? I used to think that somewhere in the American Southwest, impossible to say exactly where, all of these wonders which intrigue the spirit would converge upon a climax and resolution. Perhaps in the vicinity of Weaver's Needle in the Superstition Range, in the Funeral Mountains above Death Valley, in the Smoke Creek Desert of Nevada, among the astonishing monoliths of Monument Valley, in the depths of Grand Canyon, somewhere along the White Rim under Grand View Point, in the heart of the land of standing rocks. Not so. I am convinced now that the desert has no heart, that it presents a riddle which has no answer, and that the riddle itself is an illusion created by some limitation or exaggeration of the displaced human consciousness. This at least is what I tell myself when I fix my attention on what is rational, sensible, and realistic, believing that I have overcome at last that gallant infirmity of the so-called romance, that illness, that disease, that insidious malignancy which must be chopped out of the heart once and for all, ground up, cooked, burnt to ashes, consumed. And for so long as I stay away from the desert, keep to the mountains or the sea or the city, it is possible to think myself cured. Not easy. One whiff of juniper smoke, a few careless words, one reckless and foolish poem, The Wasteland, for instance, and I become as restive, irritable, brooding, and dangerous as a wolf in a cage. In answer to the original question, then, I find myself in the end returning to the beginning, and can only say, as I said in the first place, there is something about the desert. There is something there which the mountains, no matter how grand and beautiful, lack, which the sea, no matter how shining and vast and old, does not have. Minor points on the same issue. I like horses. There is no place for horses on the ocean. And in the mountains you will learn that mules, generally speaking, are more useful. Also, of course, the people. Though rare as radium, you find, if you can find them, a superior breed in the deserts. Consider the Bedouin, the Kazakhs and Kurds, the Mongols, the Apaches, the Kalahari. Mountain people tend to become inbred and degenerate, get goiters, and no one for a long time has lived in the sea. As for those others, the wretched inhabitants of city and plain, can we even think of them, to be perfectly candid, as members of the same race? Revealing my desert thoughts to a visitor one evening, I was accused of being against civilization, against science, against humanity. Naturally, I was flattered and at the same time surprised, hurt, a little shocked. He repeated the charge. "But how," I replied, "being myself a member of humanity, albeit involuntarily, without prior consultation, could I be against humanity without being against myself, whom I love, though not very much? How can I be against science when I greatly admire, as much as any man, Thales, Democritus, Aristarchus, Faustus, Paracelsus, Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Darwin, and Einstein? And finally, how could I be against civilization when all which I most willingly defend and venerate, including the love of wilderness, is comprehended by the term?" We were not communicating very well. All night long we thrashed the matter out, burning up half a piñon pine in the process, transforming its mass into energy, warmth, light, and, toward morning, worked out a rough agreement. With his help, I discovered that I was not opposed to mankind, but only to man-centeredness, anthropocentricity, the opinion that the world exists solely for the sake of man. Not to science, which means simply knowledge, but to science misapplied, to the worship of technique and technology, and to that perversion of science properly called scientism. And not to civilization, but to culture. As an example of scientism, he suggested the current superstition that science has lengthened the human lifespan. One might as well argue that science, meaning technology, has actually reduced the average man's life expectancy to about 15 minutes, the time it takes an ICBM to cover the distance between the USSR and the USA. The superstition, my visitor pointed out, is based on a piece of trickery, statistical sleight of hand. For example, in a primitive culture without modern medical techniques, perhaps half of all the babies born die within the first year of infancy. The remainder survive and live for the normal, usual 70 years. Taking the total born and dividing by the number of full-lived survivors, the statistician announces that the average life expectancy at birth for the members of this hypothetical society is 35 years. Confusing life expectancy with lifespan, the gullible begin to believe that medical science has accomplished a miracle, lengthened human life, and persist in believing it, even though the Old Testament, written more than 3,000 years ago, refers to 70 as being the typical number of years allotted to mortal man. The heroes, naturally, lived far longer, and not in that condition of medicated survival found in a modern hospital where the patient, technically still alive, cannot easily be distinguished from the various machines to which he is connected. But this is now familiar stuff, common knowledge. Why kick around a dead horse? Far more interesting is the distinction to be made between civilization and culture.
Culture, we agreed, means the way of life of any given human society considered as a whole.
It is an anthropological term referring always to specific identifiable societies localized in history and place, and includes all aspects of such organizations, their economy, their art, their religion. The USA, for example, is not a civilization but a culture, as is the USSR. And both are essentially industrial cultures, the former in the mode of monopoly capitalism, the latter in the mode of state socialism. If they seem to be competing against each other, it is not because they are different, but because they are basically so much alike. And the more they compete, the more alike they become. Merging traffic ahead. Civilization, on the other hand, while undoubtedly a product of various historical cultures and as a category one which overlaps what we label culture, is by no means identical with culture. Cultures can exist with little or no trace of civilization, and usually do. But civilization, while dependent upon culture for its sustenance, as the mind depends upon the body, is a semi-independent entity, precious and fragile, drawn through history by the finest threads of art and idea. A process or series of events without formal structure or clear location in time and space. It is the conscious forefront of evolution, the brotherhood of great souls and the comradeship of intellect, a corpus mysticum.
The invisible republic, open to all who wish to participate, a democratic aristocracy based not on power or institutions but on isolated men. Lao Tse, Chuang Tse, Gautama, Diogenes, Euripides, Socrates, Jesus, Wat Tyler and Jack Cade, Paine and Jefferson, Blake and Burns and Beethoven, John Brown and Henry Thoreau, Whitman, Tolstoy, Emerson, Mark Twain, Rabelais and Villon, Spinoza, Voltaire, Spartacus, Nietzsche and Thomas Mann, Lucretius and Pope John XXIII, and 10,000 other poets, revolutionaries, and independent spirits, both famous and forgotten, alive and dead, whose heroism gives to human life on earth its adventure, glory, and significance. To make the distinction unmistakably clear, civilization is the vital force in human history. Culture is that inert mass of institutions and organizations which accumulate around and tend to drag down the advance of life. Civilization is Giordano Bruno facing death by fire. Culture is the Cardinal Bellarmino, after 10 years of Inquisition, sending Bruno to the stake in the Campo di Fiori. Civilization is Sartre, culture Cocteau. Civilization is mutual aid and self-defense. Culture is the judge, the law book, and the forces of law and order. Civilization is uprising, insurrection, revolution. Culture is the war of state against state or of machines against people, as in Hungary and Vietnam. Civilization is tolerance, detachment and humor, or passion, anger, revenge. Culture is the entrance examination, the gas chamber, the doctoral dissertation, and the electric chair. Civilization is the Ukrainian peasant Nestor Makhno fighting the Germans, then the Reds, then the Whites, then the Reds again. Culture is Stalin and the Fatherland. Civilization is Jesus turning water into wine. Culture is Christ walking on the waves. Civilization is a youth with a Molotov cocktail in his